We made this.
Hello everyone, it's Matthew Latham yet again with another edition of Pick a Disc, and this time I'm so glad to introduce my guest, John Porrabill from the Play Disc podcast, which is a very similar podcast with a very similar name with a very similar premise. So instead of my first initial idea, which was to try and sue them, I thought, you know what, I'll try and invite them onto the podcast instead. So John is on here to talk about Dan Byrne's Dan Byrne album. Yeah, it's one of those like self-titled albums that you... that people seem to do, and we have a chat about that. We have a talk about Dan Byrne's lyrical style, the way he sings, a bit of his influences, etc., 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 and we delve into what happens to him after the album, and it's an interesting conversation about him out of all this. So yeah, and so that's all really I can do to hype it up. The only if you want to learn more about what's on the episode, you're going to have to listen to the episode. Unfortunately, you're going to have to devote an hour of your time to it. I don't make the rules. Also, part of the rules is that if you like this, you're going to have to share and promote and do whatever you can to support the podcast. You know, follow us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, join the Facebook group, etc., 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 etc. One of the things you can do as well is, as always, commit opinion fraud and tell us we're 5 stars worthy on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else that reviews podcasts. If you have blogs that review podcasts, just lie through your teeth and just say how great we are and how coherent and easy to understand the host is. Talking about easy to understand, let's have a conversation about Dan Byrne with John Porrabill of the Play Disc podcast. At the time of recording, I think the day before, you announced that you was moving your podcast, which is a fortnightly podcast, to an alternative week, which so it doesn't clash with mine, which is a success for me. So my plan to get every single podcast that releases on a Tuesday to no longer release on a Tuesday, so I'm the only podcast to release on a Tuesday.
Right.
That's one down, and that's so many...
Call that a half victory, right?
Yes, yes. And I don't know how many left, but there's possibly millions left to go. So my question...
You know, that's a very Dan Byrne-esque goal that you have there.
Okay, yeah, on topic straight away. But yeah, I was trying to... I saw that and I was like, it wasn't planned, honest, but yeah, my plan to try and dominate Tuesdays, it has a long way to go, but yeah. Anyway, John Porrabill from the Play Disc podcast is my guest week, people, and I'm glad you're here, but basically to the club of podcasts with the word disc in it.
We were frankly a little mortified when we learned that there was another podcast named Pick a Disc, and we were like, oh my gosh, it's the exact same podcast.
we'll briefly talk about that a bit more at the end, but we're here to talk about something else. We're here to talk about an album that you've picked. So John, why don't you tell the lovely listeners the disc that you've picked?
The disc that I've picked today is the self-titled debut full-length album by Dan Byrne, called Dan Byrne, from 1997.
Yes, and it's Dan Byrne, a singer-songwriter from...
Iowa,
yes. I had that. Mm-hmm. It's amazing when the tab that I had was no longer open. Yes, so a singer-songwriter from Iowa who's... been singing and touring for decades. Yep, this album came out on March the 4th, 1997. It's a folk rock album, and it's one of those episodes where there's not a lot of information on the artist or the album in question. So basically, John got me to try and do some proper work for once, rather than relying on Wikipedia.
Earning your keep there, Matt.
Yes, yes. So, but John, why have you picked the album?
So I have a podcast of my own that I co-host with my brother Harrison. And I often share with Harrison music that I've discovered that excites me. And when I first showed this album to Harrison, he disliked it so much that he thought I was joking.
Okay.
But I love it. I love this album. And I felt like I kind of couldn't discuss it on my own show because I don't want to alienate my own co-host. So we're going to talk about it on your show.
Okay. Okay. Which is fair enough. I mean, it's fair enough. But... But why this album specifically? Is there any reasons that you liked it in general? Or?
Yeah, the first time I heard this album, and the first track I heard from it was Jerusalem, the first song on here, and I think it was the one he released as a single. It just floored me. He's funny and poetic, and in a way that the humor kind of does and does not undercut the poetry of these lyrics. He walks this line where you're not sure to what extent he's in on the joke, in a way that's difficult to explain. Those opening lines are, when I tell you that I love you, don't test my love, accept my love, which is boilerplate enough. And then he says, because maybe I don't love you all that much. And I'm already just engrossed in this voice of somebody who's saying these things that most people just aren't, that most songwriters would be too tactful to say.
Okay, and that attracted you to it then, yeah?
So that's yes.
Okay. So you say that Jerusalem was the first track that you heard from.
Yeah.
So how did you discover Dan? How long ago have you known of him, and how did you listen? When was the first time you listened to him?
I bet you a lot of people pick discs and come on the show and they say that they've listened to, they're picking nostalgia choices, things they listened to in their youth when they were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's a common theme, right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
I was a wee lad of about 28 years old when I discovered Dan Byrne. A friend of mine from a songwriting community I'm a part of, we were in an IRC chat room. They still exist. And he was listening to a playlist of artists who had headline shows at that year's South by Southwest. And he commented that one of the songs he listened to reminded him of Dan Byrne. I said, "Who's that?" And he said, "Oh yeah, he's the guy who did Jerusalem." I was like, I don't know this song. And he sent me a link and it enraptured me. Like, those first lines were great. And then Jerusalem is a song that kind of has a punchline. And, I will admit, I laughed my head off. I found it hilarious, but it's not just a novelty song, because I keep coming back to it and I keep finding things to like about it when I come back to it, even when the joke has been spoiled, you know? So I sought out the whole album that song was on, and I found out it turns out to have been his first album, his debut, and I found more like that. I don't think there's anything else on the album that is as overtly hilarious as Jerusalem is, but I found that same style of poetry, that very blunt but still poetic voice that he has, which is remarkable to me, and this character, this megalomaniacal character that he plays throughout this album, who, while still painting his songs with vivid imagery, also doesn't bother with, like, the modesty of that you associate with a lot of great songwriters, where he's very open about wanting to have power and wanting to be loved and wanting to be king of the world and just thinking he's great.
So I'm guessing it's the attraction of Jerusalem that drew you into the album then, from the sounds of it. So, and
oh, definitely.
Yeah, the next question I usually ask is, was this the first album from them you listened to? And you've answered that question. So
it was.
Yeah. So before we quickly go into the album question, the disclosure bit from me about my history with Dan Byrne is that pretty much you mentioned, oh, I want to talk about Dan Byrne, and I've never listened to him. And I've never heard of him at all, which, I mean, looking into it, I think it's a bit understandable because he doesn't seem to have a massive global outreach more than anything. The only kind of cultural zeitgeist thing that I might have found from him is that the song Jerusalem appeared on Welcome to the Night Vale, which apparently that song appeared on one of the episodes, or I don't know that much about Welcome to the Night Vale, if I'm completely honest, but I know it's appeared on that, and apparently that's how a lot of people know that song. It's the only song I think on Genius that has annotations as well, because it appeared on that. But yeah, so I think when I started listening to it, it kind of, I wasn't sure what to expect, but it's very much a singer-songwriter, like a guy in his acoustic, which I remember I was like really into that kind of music about 5 or 6 years ago. And I now quite a few friends that are in that same kind of like level of like touring musicians kind of thing. And yeah, so it gave me kind of a nostalgia kick for that, like when I was listening to that a lot more than I was now and stuff. And I was quite surprised actually when I found I liked his page on Facebook, that no one that I was friends with, who I would have thought perhaps would have known of Dan Byrne at least, or have been in that same circles, now none of my friends liked the page, which is kind of weird actually, considering that in the past anything remotely the same sound, there's been at least the same two or three people that I'm friends with on Facebook that have also liked the page. So this is quite a journey into the unknown for me anyway. So
great.
Yeah.
So. That's another reason I always like when I can have the opportunity to do something like this. I definitely don't want to go broad. I want to pick the the underground choice, the one that will be new to a lot of people listening, I think.
So I've always got a soft spot for like passion, like old passion bands, so to speak, where like people feel quite strongly about them to try and celebrate, or at least the album anyway, that and trying to get more people to listen. So yeah, and I actually quite liked it actually as well. Again,
that's
that
good. I was a little worried about how you were going to react to it.
I mean, yeah, it's a kind of a genre that I was I'm familiar with anyway, in style I was familiar with, and I mean, I was quite surprised it was actually all the way back in 97, if I was honest, because I remember there's like, I've listened to albums similar to this released in like the last 5 or 6 years. The last decade even, and you can kind of feel the same influences that other albums that have things. Well, for example, mm-hmm. There's Bob Dylan. There's like Bob Dylan's all over the album.
Dan Byrne, as you may guess, gets compared to Bob Dylan a lot, and he was asked about this in an interview, and he kind of quipped, "Yeah, I guess Bob Dylan was kind of the Dan Byrne of the '60s, wasn't he?"
I think I remember reading that. Yeah, I remember reading that quite actually. Yeah. I've actually copied and pasted it into my notes actually, yeah. So, but there's definitely like Dylan's, but there's a lot of other influences as well. Mm-hmm. And like one song in particular, I'll bring it up later on. There's another song on there which sounds so much like it belongs on another album that was covered on Picadisc.
Oh yeah.
That I had to go back and listen to that album or skim through it to make sure that it wasn't basically lifting the melody of it.
Oh wow!
Well, if that gets brought up, if you bring that song up, I'll let you know which song that is.
Or, okay.
So yeah. So well, let's talk about the album as a whole. Then. So if I was to ask you about your immediate highlights and stuff, so I'm going to assume anything that's not Jerusalem, any other, because I know you've quickly mentioned about that. What other highlights from the album would you jump out if you wanted to try and sing more praises about it?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, this is one of those albums for me where there aren't any duds. Like, I don't skip any of the songs when I listen. I love every song on this album, but I do have a couple of favorites. I want to point out Marilyn, which is his sort of fan fiction about Marilyn Monroe. This is a song where the premise is Marilyn Monroe in real life married Arthur Miller. And Dan Byrne thinks to himself, well, what if she married Henry Miller, the noted erotic fiction writer, and sort of pictures a much more libertine life for Marilyn, where she's less restricted and possibly doesn't die. I liked it a lot. This is one of the ones that my brother, when he first heard it, was like, why should I be interested in this Gen X guy's fan fiction about Marilyn Monroe? And I'm like, I don't know. I just like the image of like the world's most famous bombshell being married to a guy who actually lets her be herself. And like picturing how different that life would have been.
Yeah, it's an interesting song. I mean, after a couple of listens, it took me a while to figure out what the song was actually saying. And yeah, I think as you said, there was that kind of like sense of humour throughout mm-hmm. it. And like, there's quite, I won't quote it verbatim, but there's not exactly graphic, but there's some strong language in the scripting of their yeah. relationship that ends up getting through that stuff. But
this is that bluntness I was talking about.
Yeah.
Where one of the lines in the song is, if she did, he'd have taken her to Paris. And if she did, they'd have fucked every day.
Yeah.
And like Bob Dylan wouldn't have sang that. I know that.
Yeah. But there's a bit as well where he cuts into like, I think it's like either the second or third verse where he goes, this is not a knock against Arthur Miller.
Yep.
And Death of the Sasmi is my favorite play. And it's and there's that, I think it's like a good example of very straight-laced narrative, like storytelling, where mm-hmm. and I noticed as well is that he's not really asked about rhyming either.
I've listened to this album so many times that I don't even notice the fact that a lot of these songs don't rhyme, and I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's almost no rhyming in Marilyn or Jerusalem or a couple of other songs. Just don't have them. He doesn't care.
I think it kind of frees up the very bluntness of like what he's aiming to do with it, and I think yeah, so he doesn't have to try and force feed or rhyme and everything. I mean, it probably robs perhaps the usual like memorable kind of catchiness of rhyming in general.
True.
In terms of lyrics and stuff. But yeah, it just makes him free to like pretty much describe basically defending himself about that he's not attacking Arthur Miller and everything. So mm-hmm. What else? What other songs do you think?
I also really like Too Late to Die Young.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the ones... I think it does... That one does rhyme, I think. Let me check. Kind of. And that's... If we look at Marilyn and then we look at Too Late to Die Young, we start to realize that Dan Byrne has kind of a cultural fascination with some of the figures of his parents' generation, because he's talking about Elvis and James Dean and Marilyn Monroe, and a couple of the other songs have references to, like, Muhammad Ali and Pete Rose. Pete Rose and Roberto Clemente are in this song, Marlon Brando. So he does have this fascination that I think some people criticize him for. I think he's been like, hey, if this is supposed to be like Gen X Bob Dylan, then why is he fascinated with all the same figures that the baby boomers were fascinated with? Which I think is valid, but I don't care. because I think it's a unique point of view. And if he's interested in these figures, then let him sing about them. He has this, basically the thesis statement of Too Late to Die Young is one that comes up a lot in like hipster music circles because of the prevalence of musicians who did die young. People like, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, the whole 27 Club mythology. And then you have somebody like Elvis, which is the whole point of this song, which is that look at Elvis. I mean, he was great, but not a lot would have been lost culturally if he had died maybe 20 years earlier than he did. And that's, it's a mean point of view. It's very cynical. I don't think it's wrong, but, and he's sort of musing, and I relate to this pretty hard because now I'm 34 years old and I'm thinking the same thing where, like, I have outlived all these people who died in their peaks. And that's weird.
I say I've not noticed that kind of aim in the lyrics right until you brought it up, but it's an, I mean, like, he's saying it does sound kind of mean when he's saying, like, yeah, if it's too late to die young and be immortalized forever. But I think there was something like going around for ages about people that, the idea that I think it's more a society that kind of aims to get people while young and then throw them out once they pass their sell by date. And you find that perhaps with a lot of artists, I mean, modern day contemporaries, I think. And it's something that it's something that happens with female singers, female actresses all the time.
Yeah.
All the time, in that as soon as they reach a certain age, it's like the Hunger Games in terms of trying to stay culturally relevant because of age. Indeed. And stuff. And it's not the 90s. It's one of the things about the whole Hollywood / music industry bit that kind of annoys me once you get to a certain age and stuff. But then you've got examples afterwards. Like, I think Alan Rickman had his first acting job when he was 45, and J.K. Rowling was like late 30s, I think, before she even published her first book.
And they're
like examples of people that say, like, you're never too young to...
Never too old, right? Yeah. Never too old to start again.
Yeah, well, sorry, you're never too old to start again.
Yeah.
Might as well get the right word out. But I do quite like the aim of that song when it makes sense when you describe it. So, anything else do you want to bring up while here?
Yeah, if we're going to talk about the cynicism of the way Hollywood uses people up, we have to talk about Wasteland, right? This is another one where his fascination with pop culture figures is really on full display. He's talking about Marilyn Monroe again. He's talking about James Dean again, Joe DiMaggio, and the song opens with a paraphrase of a Howl of Allen Ginsberg. I saw the best of my generation playing pinball, made up and caked up, looking like some kind of China doll. This song, the funny thing is, I feel like if I had heard this song when I was younger, it wouldn't have spoken to me quite the way it does right now. As a listener who's noticed my own disconnection from youth culture and pop culture over the last few years, like especially since I had a child of my own, this song speaks to me especially hard. I'm going to read a passage of the lyrics here. And I watched TV and read the papers and listened to the radio and made all the fancy scenes and said all the right words and wore all the right clothes and knew the names of all the hip people, but I still felt out of touch. So I stopped watching TV and reading the papers and listening to the radio and making the fancy scenes and saying the right words and wearing the right clothes and knowing the names of the hip people. And I felt more out of touch than ever, but I didn't care anymore. This is one of those that doesn't rhyme, by the way. And I swear, it sounds better when he sings it. I mean, it sounds like I'm just rambling when I just read the lyrics. But the way, even though these songs don't rhyme, they do have a sort of rhythm to them that makes them really jump out when he sings them over his guitar in a way that I find really appealing. But this idea of being in a populous, pop culture obsessed city, urban center, and just feeling totally isolated, specifically because of that culture's fascination with the ephemerality of fame and the ephemerality of whatever is cool, and realizing that you're not playing that game. And it can feel liberating, but it doesn't make you feel any less isolated.
Talking about, I think, some of the points in things that jump out is that it is pretty much, because it's not rhyming, but it is kind of, he uses quite a few poetic techniques. There's a lot of repeated frames. So for example, like with and they run and till sept I now and you and broken and like and I and but basically he's doing a lot of repeated. That was me just going through and nearly going through the whole song and saying the first word of every line. And I thought I'll stop before I get to
that was almost as funny as you doing a dramatic reading of Ludacris last episode. That was great. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, but I think, and. also, but he just uses a lot of the repeated techniques, and for example, with the broken up in, and signs for, where it's kind of like, he uses repetition a lot in this song. And
yes,
with the beat that you rang, each line says, and I watch this, but, and then breaks it up with, but I fell out of touch, and then listen to this, and then listen to this, I fell more out of touch, and then I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this. It doesn't rhyme, but it kind of, instead of backloads the points like I think normal conventional songwriting does, he front loads it, and he's like spoken word poetry just to a melody rather, which pretty much is probably all of songs when you think about it. But
well, it's no coincidence that in this song out of all the songs on the album, he's paraphrasing Allen Ginsberg, who's one of the most famous beat poets. So, I mean, I would hesitate to call these lyrics a beat poem, but they're definitely inspired by the beats and not just in that he's quoting Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, I mean, if he was just a poet and not a singer, I'd fully buy that this was a poet, because looking at it without the music, it reads like it is a poem.
100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The one song I want to bring up, and it's the one I alluded to earlier, is Rome. What are your feelings on Rome?
I'll tell you what, I was just listening to this album a couple more times this morning in prep for this episode, and that was the one question I was just like, I'm gonna have to hope he doesn't ask me that. Because Rome, I mean, okay, first of all, it's a mood piece, right? I mean, it's very, very moody. You're listening to it, and I almost have a hard time processing the lyrics, because it's all about this gloomy, dark mood, and he's very angry, and I'm not 100% sure about what. I think we're talking about a story of some people who are like on a road trip, and the road trip runs long, and they just hate each other by the end, and Rome is the last stop, and they're just like, I was having fun for a little bit, but right now I just hate you guys. I just, you know, that kind of thing. And there's a lot of metaphor in this song, so I'm not really 100% sure what the literal narrative is.
See, because it kind of jumps out, because it's like the first one that kind of gets quite, like the one that gets like really dark, and it's like, I don't want to say like an outlier, but it doesn't stick out that much as a sore thumb, but it does sound quite different to all the other ones. And I was listening to it, and I honestly thought, the first time I was listening to it, that my Spotify played up and it started playing Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Oh, okay.
It reminds me so much of something that was on Murder Ballads, which it was like all the way back in 2015 was the first album I ever covered under the concept of Pick a Disc, and you can actually listen to it in episode 11 if you want to listen back, of course. And I'm pretty sure, you know, the way he sings it, his voice is a bit deeper. It's a lot more very Nick Cave.
Well, sure.
Very kind of pretty much minor keys all the way through it. When I tell you I love you, don't tell. And I was pretty sure, and it reminded me so much of, I can't remember what song it was, but the melody he says just kind of was in my head, and I'm sure I couldn't remember whether it was Lifted or something. But and when I was listening, and I had to listen to Murder Ballads again, or just flick through it trying to figure out what song it reminded me of. And okay, it doesn't feel like it's Lifted completely, but the closest thing I can perhaps think it
I hear it,
me
man.
Of,
yeah,
was like, I think Henry Lee or something, or but because it's not the longest song on the album, but it's long enough to feel like it's a natural Murder Ballad off that. So it's got like a very narrative voice. And at one point, I thought it was a cover. I thought it was a cover of Nick Cave at one point, because it just feels so much like he's doing, like if a few of the songs are very Bob Dylan-esque.
Yeah, yeah.
And perhaps a couple of others might be kind of like flirting on the edge of Springsteen, which might actually sound like a good album. So if anyone wants to use that, you talk to my people and, so this one's like kind of flirting on the edge of Nick Cave. Less flirting on the edge, more or less diving in, like the introduction of Bojack diving into Nick Cave. But, and it just, it, I mean, like,
and he's so disillusioned with Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No,
if Marilyn Monroe didn't marry Henry, man, I can't think of an animal pun. If I could have thought of an animal pun, that would be great. I just thought I really want to mention that because it's got, I mean, you're saying I, in terms of the narrative and how it fits in with other stuff, you're quite right in that it doesn't seem to fit in. But I think the fact that it seems so tonally different to a lot of other things and reminds me so much of Nick Cave was why it stood out. And I generally thought I actually started, it was starting to play a Nick Cave song at one point. So.
Yeah, and you know, musically I can hear it too. It's just the acoustic guitar and the, there's a bass. I can't tell if it's a bowed bass instrument or if it's just a bass guitar. And then the accordion.
Yeah.
And that's all we get. And that is also Nick Cave-esque. I hadn't made that connection, but as soon as you said Nick Cave, I was like, Oh, it does sound like Nick Cave, very much so.
But I like that one. I will have to point out as well is that I want to quickly mention "Go to Sleep," which is the second track. I actually really like that one, and I can probably see that perhaps jumping onto the playlist of all the songs that I usually have. This is me being slightly geeking that I found how to use the smarter playlists functionality of Spotify and found out how to automatically shuffle two playlists into one playlist. And
ooh.
Google Home, at like when I went to wake me up to go to work, will basically play this playlist of two ones. So I've got all the current songs I like and a few old favourites. So I might stick Go to Sleep in the old favourites, so it might wake me up.
Oh, cool.
that's how much I really like Go to Sleep, actually.
I like that song a lot too. That's one of the more overtly satirical songs that where you can really tell he's being sarcastic. Where it's like, just go out and buy something already. Like, don't think about things. Don't respect old art. Just, you know, new. Buy things. Which, it's more of a blunt instrument, I think, than some of the other songs on the album, but I still like it a lot. especially the verse about barcodes.
Yeah, but also, and also keeping in track of pretty much other albums, it's like one of the shortest on the album and not really very long.
Oh, you like short songs, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite rare that really long songs get into, or love really long songs. Anything that passes like 5.5 minutes, and you've got to be really good to try and keep my attention. But like Go to Sleep, kind of like, I think it's pretty much after the introduction of Jerusalem, it kind of punches in. It's kind of punchy, snappy, short, and it's kind of. The first instance of memorable is, I remember listening to that song, I'm like, that was the first song on the album where I was like, oh, actually, this is actually really good. I mean, not that I didn't like Jerusalem.
Jerusalem is solo guitar, and I'm not convinced it wasn't recorded live.
Mm-hmm.
I think he may have gone up on an open mic stage or something like that, because that's the vibe of the song for sure, is, you know, just one guy and a guitar and, like, don't ask me what I'm going to play tonight, just listen. And then I think we needed that for a second step to be like, okay, the whole album's not going to be like this. I do have a band. And that was refreshing.
Yeah, I think with Jerusalem is quite, and I don't know if I've used this term on the podcast before, but verbose, which is there, like, in terms of, like, I always think the songs with, like, that are lyrically dense, and not, I don't mean lyrically dense as in, like, very technical rapping things in that, but songs that have a lot of lyrics and not a lot of repeated lyrics.
Yeah.
A lot of repeated lyrics, like, one of my favourite bands, Los Camazinos, has quite a few songs that are quite, I would describe them as verbose in terms of, like, they just seem to carry on and on and on, and Dan Burns got a lot of songs where he'll just go on, like, really long,
prosaic.
Yeah. So it's not, so he doesn't go into like verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, uh-huh, chorus, chorus. And he'll just tell a story and, like, he won't care if it takes 2 minutes or 7 yeah, minutes to finish and stuff. Like, because I'm looking at the lyric sheet I've got in front of me, Estelle, which is like 7.5 mm-hmm, minutes, which,
longest on the album.
Yeah. Which, yep. Okay. Some, it probably does outstay the Matt Latham tolerance for a song length, which needs a better name. But I do,
the Latham limit.
Yes, the Latham limit. Yes. Okay. Yeah. I should refer to
that. We have exceeded the Latham limit.
The Latham limit. Yeah. So it surpasses the Latham limit just a touch, but it does. I think it does quite well in that it keeps it interesting. Doesn't repeat a lot of it. So if it was like the same chorus repeating over and over and over again, for 7 minutes, then he probably, the Latham limit would have dropped off a long time before then. But again,
Estelle does have a chorus in it, and I like that it feels like a relieving of tension every time that the two times that chorus comes up.
Yeah, but I mean, saying in a 7 minute song, it's only there twice. It still gives you an example of
indeed
verses and how much he crams into that.
As opposed to Jerusalem, which does not have a chorus at all, unless you count the Don't Test My Love part, which is the beginning and end. And we were talking about him being verbose. I mean, like the line about waiting, or the section of the song about waiting. I've got it pulled up here. I know how I hate to wait, like even for a bus or something, an important phone call. So I can just imagine how darn impatient everyone must be getting. Like, the verbosity was the point of that song. Like, the fact that he's singing, but he's also just rambling.
There's a very interesting, what's the word? Not contrast. Dichotomy here, uh-huh, I'll probably have to bring up as well, is that there's a lot of lyrics here, and a lot of poets, and I don't know whether it doesn't seem to go on, well, it goes on too long on a couple of tracks, but I mean, at what point, and I think as a songwriter yourself, at what point do you look at a song and then think, okay, it's perhaps too long, perhaps I should cut it down? Or do you think that, I mean, you know the album a lot more than I do. Do you think that if you was Dan Byrne at the time and someone said to you, you might need to cut some lyrics or cut it down, do you think it could be possible or not?
Ooh. Are you talking about the whole album or just Estelle in particular?
I think probably Estelle at the moment, or if there's any other songs you know of, but like whether to make it more accessible, or do you think Dan Byrne could have cut the amount of lyrics to perhaps jump it down to 4 minute song rather than seven, or do you think it will lose something?
I think maybe he could have. The part about the dog, I think maybe is possibly low hanging fruit if you're looking to edit something out. I don't know if I'd want that. I don't know if it would be a lesser song for that. I feel like it might be. It's hard for me to. The Estelle is setting up a weird narrative, but it also is doing a lot of heavy lifting to try and get you to figure out what kind of guy the narrator is, even though he's kind of an unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's the purpose of that line about the dog, or not the line, the verse about the dog is letting us know that this is a guy who is misanthropic and susceptible to rumor, and that he's very capricious. And so, I mean, the lyric, the narrative of this verse is that his best friend is a dog, and the dog went everywhere with him, and he loved this dog. But then he heard a rumor that there were crack addicts kidnapping dogs and selling them for research. And even though he didn't think it was true, he stopped bringing the dog around places.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not germane to the story, but it does kind of tell us what kind of thought process is this weird guy who's the narrator of this song has. That he's prone to this erratic behavior based on very little evidence.
Yeah, I think you're saying that. I mean, as I'm looking for the lyrics now, it's, again, that kind of rambling. Maybe I'll take back the whether it's too long or not, because I'll take that back, because like reading through it, it's like, you know, like those kind of guys you sit next to and like, yeah, they start talking and then just like basically Grandpa Simpson a sentence. Yeah.
I was wearing an onion on my belt, which was the style of the time, and
yeah, basically the world's longest sentence or rap stories that don't seem to go anywhere. It kind of does have that feeling. Like as I'm looking at the verse about the dog, that's when it suddenly cuts into like trying to hang around with the friends and stuff, and then jumps into the titled Estelle,
yeah.
And like. Yeah, and I think as you said, it's an unreliable narrator. I think, yeah. I think I'm going to have to re-listen to that. I'm going to have to re-listen to the song again, just to...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry to subject that to you.
Yeah, just to kind of, like, look at the story. I mean, because I'm quite into, like, completely random tangent, but my video game taste is more based on the narrative and stories that they tell, and perhaps... And yeah, I probably need to revisit Estelle and just think of it with the idea that the person is like the unreliable narrator, and you have to try and read into it again. Because I quite like the idea of revisiting stuff and building stuff again, which is very similar to the if not as complex, dense as the A Grand Don't Come for Free by the Streets. Pick a few episodes ago. I think perhaps Estelle might, from what you're saying, might, if I give it a chance and not get too took up on the length and try and read into the narrative, as you say, read into the narrative of what the person's trying to talk about, then perhaps my opinion on it might change.
I hope it does. It's one of my favorite songs on the album, and that was the only one that I really wanted to talk about that we hadn't yet. So
yeah, so I can't think of any others that jump out at me to talk about, because I think Rome was the one I wanted to talk about, and Go to Sleep, which I really really liked. Question that I sometimes ask songwriters, and cause you said you've done songwriting and in the past, and question that I always kind of want to. I don't ask it often. I only asked it a couple of times with songwriters, and sometimes keep forgetting to ask. But has this album influenced you as a songwriter at all?
Maybe. It was around the time when I discovered this album. It was around the time, shortly before or shortly after, I came out with my still most recent album. So I haven't done a whole lot of songwriting and recording since Dan Byrne started bouncing around between my ears. But I think maybe one song I think has some of that energy to it. I have a song. Well, actually, now that I think about it, the song is called Next Year in Jerusalem, which has Jerusalem in the title. So that has sort of that verbose energy to it. I don't know. I don't know if I'd consider him an influence on me. I just don't think I don't think I've done enough work of my own since then for that to be a possibility.
Okay. That's fair enough there. It's a question I keep meaning to ask any songwriters that I speak to on the podcast and sometimes forget. It's like when I always forget to talk about the artwork, which, bringing up, let's have a quick mention about the artwork because I remembered to talk about it.
Sure.
So, yeah, for the first time in, like, forever, which basically I think is just a photo with a Photoshop effect on it.
Yeah. He's walking down the street with a guitar. It's blurry. You can't... It's funny because it's like artist portrait, but you can't make out his face.
Yeah.
Which I think is part of the point that he's trying to like satirize this. It's in a lot of ways, this is kind of an anti-folk album where he's like, he's doing the like Bob Dylan folk movement type style, but also lacking the pretension of that style, and not universally. I mean, some of the songs are pretentious as heck, but other ones like Jerusalem and like King of the World are he's like eager to poke holes in that aesthetic by being so openly egomaniacal. And blunt. I've said blunt like 6 times during this episode. and I think this is part of that too, this sort of parody of the image of a folk singer just walking down the street playing guitar.
Yeah, because he's kind of like in mid-stride.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a kind of in mid-stride, kind of like he's kind of, his hips almost twisting, like he's kind of like walking almost catwalk-like.
Yeah,
on that and stuff, but it's very quite basic. But there's probably a lot that you can read into. And yay, I finally remembered to talk about the artwork on an episode. Yay, I'm so proud of myself. And
congratulations.
Yes, and I look forward to episode 43 when I remember again. So
yes.
so let's move on to the reception of the album. And as I said earlier, this is an artist and album that doesn't have that much on about it online, apart from All Music and an archived magazine interview that I lost the link to, but I think Brett Hakenbach, which is the review of All Music, starts up his review on allmusic.com as, "Everyone knows that hype kills, and being touted as the next anything, especially the next Bob Dylan, is usually, for the most part, the kiss of death. So yep. For those of you turned off by such things, we'll skip those kind of superlatives because this record should not be missed. In a genre that on the surface seems to be progressing, but in reality is becoming staler each year, Dan Byrne's take on funk music is refreshing to say the least. Byrne doesn't treat the music with kid gloves, nor does he try to beautify or jazz it up. He simply attacks the music in much the same way as Dylan did." And he then starts bringing up a few songs and stuff, but
I agree with that.
So yeah, so I think that touches on quite a few things that you mentioned as well, in that it takes on folk music, but and okay, this was like 1997. I think I've listened to something that sounds quite similar to this, but perhaps not in the same kind of jokey way, in poetic kind of long prose way. So in terms of like where it says it takes on folk music, was you much a fan of folk music before this album? Was you a fan?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And especially like around the time I was listening, around the time I discovered this, I was really into like new folk music. I mean, they call it new folk because it's like artists from like the late 2000s and through like mid-teens who were putting out this kind of modern, polished adult contemporary sound that was very much inspired by the folk music. So I'm talking about people like Martin Sexton or Dar Williams, or like Kate Wolfe. So like acoustic based music with very traditional structures, but a lot of modern studio polish, was part of that aesthetic. And I was a big fan of that. And this is folk, but it's not, I wouldn't lump it in with those new folk people because it's not polished and it's, not afraid to be blunt and rough when the song calls for it. Oh, I said blunt again. he is. He's just, you know.
It tells it as it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Or sometimes as it very obviously is not. For instance, I don't sincerely believe Dan Byrne is the Messiah, but to hear a folk singer on a solo guitar just yelling out, "I am the Messiah, I am the Messiah," you're like, so he went there. Okay. Yeah. Yes, I think you heard me.
No, yeah, I mean, you can't fault him for that. So, from the one person I could find stuff on, then it's positive anyway. So, I mean, I don't think he's on Metacritic. I don't think, unless I've forgotten to look. But,
he's not even on Metacritic. If you search Dan Byrne on Metacritic, he doesn't come up at all, which is weird. Metacritic has some weird gaps like that sometimes.
Okay. So, have you ever seen him live?
No, I have not.
No.
And, you know, there's an asterisk to that question because his career has recently sort of had a turning point, which we can talk about in a second. And in fact, if you... You know what? Put a pin in it. We'll come back.
Okay.
I have not seen him live. I hope to at some point soon.
Okay. So, and if anyone listening listens to the album, wants to listen to more of Dan Byrne. Have you listened to any other songs off his discography? Because there's a lot of them. So there's a lot of stuff.
He's been prolific. So, very straightforward answer. If you want to continue with Dan Byrne, this is his first full-length album. I'm going to go ahead and put in a plug for your listeners to go check out his most recent album. Came out in 2019. It's called Regent Street. And the reason is that the week after this episode airs, my podcast, Play Disc, with myself and my brother Harrison, we're going to be talking about Regent Street.
Okay.
And the reasoning for that is we like to find albums that we have like an interesting take on and that have an interesting story, something that we can like something that we can sort of hang a narrative on. How's this for a narrative? In 2018, Dan Byrne had a snowblower accident and he lost the tips of two of his fingers. And so he had to transition from being primarily a guitarist, which he's been all his life, to being primarily a pianist. And it did something to his creative process, for sure, because it's a very different energy from any of his previous albums. And it is something that I would consider a late career masterpiece. Like when somebody who's been working consistently for almost 30 years, and you think they don't have any surprises left in them, and they come out with something that hits you as hard as their early work did, and you're like, whoa, he did have it in him. That's Regent Street. And Harrison and I will be talking about that on date of publication. Our episode should come out 7 days later.
Oh, okay.
So stay tuned for that one.
Okay. So, now, and the swift plug there before I allowed you to. I saw that, John.
That's a false start. Now, if you want a more straightforward answer, I think, and stop me if you've heard this one before, where you should go next in Dan Byrne's catalog depends on what it is about this self-titled album that you liked. So if you really like the Dylan-esque poetry of a more like traditional folk sound, probably the one you want to go for is New American Language, which, actually, let me check. I don't know where that one came in his album order, but I can at least tell you the year it came out. That was his 2001 album. That's a much more traditional style folk album. It has some of the like abrasive satire on it, but it's overall much more polished than the self-titled album is. If that abrasiveness is what you liked about this debut, I'm going to say it one more time, if that bluntness is what you liked, then maybe you should do what I did and what I wouldn't recommend otherwise, which is continue on to his second album. 1998, came out with an album called 50 Eggs. Just a sneak preview. First song on 50 Eggs is called Tiger Woods, and after some dramatic minor key strumming, the first lyrics you hear in the album are, I got big balls. Yeah, that's the energy he was going for on that album. So on 50 Eggs, he's really leaning into the elements of his lyrics that are sort of uncomfortable. So he has a whole song on that album. Tiger Woods is basically a big machismo bravado song, largely about his balls. No Missing Link is a song where he's satirizing religious belief, and it's a song all about how they're never going to find a missing link because aliens came I listened to 50 Eggs and it actually scared me off the rest of Dan Byrne's catalog for a while. I was like, never mind. But eventually I did come back and listen to more of his stuff. And so New American Language is one I'd recommend as a more like standard polished album. He also came out with a really interesting album in 2015 called Hoodie. And it's actually more of a country album. It was really good. And then skip ahead to the most recent one, Regent Street, where he's transitioned to being a piano since his handicap. And he has a really interesting perspective. And I think the current political situation has also informed his songwriting in a way, because he's a lot more sincere about a lot of things. Whereas I think before he was more willing to play for the sake of a joke. He was more willing to play a megalomaniacal character. Now he's a lot more about, I'll put it another way. Now he's a lot less reticent about calling out tyranny where he sees it. And there are several overtly political songs on Regent Street, like a song called America Without the People, which is very much anti-Trump. And it ends on a song called Take the Guns Away, which is about American firearms policy. And a few other songs in that vein.
I'm definitely be interested in having a listen to Regent Street then. So I'll definitely should be checking that out before.
I recommend it highly. It blew my mind, moved me to tears.
Yeah, definitely should be checking out that, particularly like as a bookend to listen to this one anyway. So we're coming up to the end of the podcast now, and
yes,
we're here, and it's time for the most important bit, which is for you to pick a song to be immortalized forever in the Spotify Hall of Fame. And for those of you listening for the first time, the Spotify Hall of Fame playlist basically means that the guest gets to pick a song to add to it, which I have no control over. Even on the special episodes that I've picked the disc and have a guest host, I still can't control what goes on there, which means that you get Colin putting a 10-minute Bright Eyes song on there, but which I will never... I'll never not give him crap about it. But John, so if any of the songs on the album that you want to add onto that, well, one song that you want to add on, which song do you want to pick?
I'm sorry, Matt. It's Estelle.
God, damn it. I knew that was coming.
It really is. You know, we have on our podcast a feature that we call the key track, and it's not quite the same as what you're asking here, I think. Because Harrison and I, we pick the song that we think is like most emblematic of the album, or that is like somehow representative of the album. It might be the best song on it, or it might be the one that we think is the most interesting. It's very arbitrary on our side. And I think if we were covering this album on my show, I would have had a different key track. But I think Estelle is the best song on this album. It's the one that I think is the most vivid and bright and it just makes me want to like him. And I want to put that out there, even in spite of its length. I just love hearing him ramble, and I love the major key jam going on. I love the organ in that song. Easy pick for Hall of Fame for me.
okay. I suppose I have to put it on there. It's fine. It's not the longest song. It's not the longest song that's been there, but but no. So Estelle joins the ever growing list. Playlist of
some weeks growing faster than others.
Yes, yeah. but with that, we've gone to a close. So
indeed,
John, your first guest appearance on a podcast has finished. So I hope I've not put you off doing any.
Oh
others,
gosh,
so.
No, this was a blast. I'll come back anytime you want to have me.
Oh, brilliant! And before we say goodbye to the lovely listeners, here's a chance to promote something, because I believe you have a podcast, which you've not mentioned yet.
yeah, it's really, you gotta, if you listened closely, you may have heard me mention it a couple of times. I have a show. It is called Play Disc. It is DISC, just the same way you spell it, Play Disc. And it's very similar to your show, except we don't do guests, or we do sometimes, but we don't, not as part of the format. And my brother and I just go deep into an album for about an hour, and next week we'll be covering Regent Street by Dan Byrne. You can find us on all the social networks. On Facebook, we're at Play Disc Podcast. Twitter, at Play Disc Podcast. You can find us on all the platforms that carry podcasts. If you just search Play Disc, we usually come up in the first few, in the first result or top page. We have an Instagram at Play Disc Podcast, email us at playdiscpodcast@gmail.com. And come be part of the conversation. You know, we love listening to your show and commenting on those episodes as they come out. And, hope that your listeners will enjoy what we're putting out in the world, and we'll do the same for us.
Yeah. I've basically binged the podcast episodes about a month or so ago, and basically to break it away, it's not guest led, it's just basically two of you, and you're also not afraid to talk negatively or critique an album. So if if anyone wants an example of how, as on surface level, we might be similar. If you listen to all of our episodes first, but then listen to Linkin Park again because I need the stats, and then you listen to your Linkin Park episode.
Yeah,
it's very, very different.
Yeah, I put my foot in my mouth in that first episode, but you know, it's a historical record.
But again, if everyone had the same opinion, the world would be very, very boring. But
oh yes, indeed.
Yeah, but no, it's quite interesting to hear the other team talk about that album anyway. So it's quite interesting to see what people disliked about albums that I quite liked. I fully recommend Play Disc. Just remember that when you follow to both of us, we're the one that becomes higher because of the alphabetical order. So you know which one to listen to first.
Yeah. Off.
You've also
been around longer, and you know, you're British, so yes. that gives you an edge on us as well.
Yeah, I sound like I know what I'm talking about when I really don't.
Yes.
Yeah, and again, John, thank you ever so much for appearing on the podcast. Thank you for introducing me to Dan Byrne and I really enjoy listening to it, and it's been great talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Matt.
You've been listening to Pick a Disc, and I've been your host, Matthew Laver. Our theme music is Pump by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. Pick a Disc is hosted by the We Made This Podcast Network, and you can find them on www.spreaker.com/user/WeMadeThis. You can find the Pick a Disc show site on www.spreaker.com/show/pickadisc. You can find us on all the usual social media type places like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter under Pick a Disc. You can also email us on pickadisc@gmail.com. Until next time, happy listening to all those discs that you are picking. Goodbye.
Previously on the We Made This Network. Observing the Pattern, a Fringe podcast.
You're going to meet someone who's quite important now, and yeah, this is where we're going. So, yeah, I think you're definitely right. And it then moves, it pushes the other episodes, like what's to come, like Bound and Safe and those episodes, and even Transformation, which we're going to be on in a few episodes' time. It pushes that kind of serialization, which wasn't really there before. There's hints at it, but, you know, there is definitely some sort of change that's happening, and this is the beginning of it.
We Buy Records.
Fury Dub's most treasured record is an original UK pressing of Jimi Hendrix's Electric Ladyland. Do you know this one, Paul? Do you know the cover? I think it has.
Oh, yeah, I looked it up yesterday when I was doing research. It's got naked ladies on it, Timmy.
It's got lots and lots and lots of naked ladies on it. Now, I didn't know this, but apparently Jimi Hendrix didn't like that cover, and so it was changed, which is one of the things that makes that original really rare. Maybe he was a hashtag SJW in his day. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast.
See, that's the thing. That's the one thing that kind of bothers me about this episode is that Mulder is almost, he starts off a little too much. You know what I mean? And yeah. I feel like he's playing a little hard on this scene. I think if maybe he backed off just a tiny bit, it would have been more of a progression towards madness. But he almost seems a little mad already, you know, but in a different way, in a different sense.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This Podcast Network.